Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hi, Ray.
As promised in episode 6, we're going to continue our review of the B&H report commissioned by Danske Bank to investigate what happened. What are we going to talk about today, Graham?
Well, you know, Ray, every time I look at this report, I keep seeing some innocuous-looking paragraph and finding that there's more to it than meets the eye. So I thought we'd kick off this episode and talk about the structure of Danske Bank and the reporting lines from the executive board down to branch level, how and why they might have changed over time, and the potential consequences of those changes.
Okay, that sounds a bit dry, but given that Danske got its marching orders from Estonia last week and voluntarily gave up its business in Lithuania, Latvia and Russia as well, I guess you had your reasons?
Yes, I think we need to show that whatever happened in the branch, and given there's been a large number of suspicious activity reports along with a number of arrests, it's clear that all was not well there. But the system and control failures at group level contributed to the problem, and we should learn as much as we can from those failures, which ultimately led to the events that we witnessed last week.
That sounds eminently sensible. And as usual, I've been very good and done the homework you set me, which involved, as you hinted at earlier, looking at the B&H report's explanation of the management structure of the group and how it relates to the branch in Estonia.
And what did you find, Ray?
The headline is that the bank went from a relatively simple hierarchy at the outset to a much more layered one by the time of the exiting of the non-resident portfolio.
Okay, do you want to expand on that?
Sure. Well, between 2007 and 2009, there were only three levels of management. The branch manager in Estonia reported to the head of Baltic Banking, and the head of Baltic Banking reported to the Danske CEO.
Okay, well, that's pretty straightforward. So by the end?
Well, by the end, the branch manager in Estonia still reported to the head of Baltic Banking, but the head of Baltic Banking now reported to the head of International Banking, who reported to the head of Business Banking, who was an executive board member, and they then reported to the CEO.
Okay, not quite so straightforward. So effectively, two additional reporting lines have been inserted between the top and the coalface.
Yep, that's right.
And what would you draw from that?
Well, at the very least, it requires two additional sets of eyes for information to be read and filtered by prior to getting to the head of the bank.
So, I just want to explain what you mean by filtered by.
Of course. Like with any set of data, the people at the top simply don't have the time or the inclination to dive into the detail and read every fact about every aspect of the business. With the best one in the world, that's not what they're paid for. And that's the reason why we have all these scoreboards, dashboards, heat maps and so on.
Okay, I've heard of all of those and a few more besides, I think.
Well, me too, and I've built a few of them too. The point here is that along the way, someone will attach more or less importance to different elements so that by the time it gets to the top of the house, it will inevitably reflect in one way or another the viewpoints of the people responsible in the hierarchy below, and it will have become divorced from the underlying data.
Yeah, so it's possible, but only through circumstantial evidence, that over time, the ability to raise issues of concern directly with senior managers might have become more challenging.
I think that's a fair observation.
OK, what else did you spot in this bit of the report?
Well, something that reinforced what we said in an earlier episode about the profitability of the Estonian branch.
Which was?
For the 3 years prior to the bank being bought by Danske, Estonia was the only Baltic branch that provided a return on equity.
Oh, and was it a good one?
Well, it went from 23% in 2005 to 30% in 2007, which is not bad.
That's all right. And just to remind our listeners, this was at a time when the credit crunch was just starting to bite, and yep, both capital and liquidity were starting to become a bit of an issue.
Yes, they were. The report also goes into more detail at this point with respect to the Estonian regulator's report carried out in March and April of 2007.
And again, just to remind our listeners, this was only just the point, 2007 early, that Danske had formally taken over the running of the bank. So these would have been inherited problems.
Yeah, that's right. And therefore, you might think that's the perfect time to put them right, given that there'd be no blame attached to Danske for those pre-existing issues.
So what were those issues the report highlighted?
Things we've seen before on many occasions, Graham. So the report, for instance, acknowledges that the bank had, in principle, controls. But then the report goes on to say that, quote, the bank's routine practice has not been fully in compliance with the requirements. It also says the bank has, quote, underestimated potential risks associated with providing services to legal entities registered in a low-tax area. And then, in respect of the non-resident portfolio, quote, is not in compliance with international practice and is not sufficient regarding the specifics of the activities of this particular client group and associated risks.
Well, now, there's quite a lot to talk about in those few sentences, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, if we allow for the fact that regulators habitually use rather dry language, even when things are clearly not right, this is quite a criticism.
Yes, and at a time when dark money and financial crime were just definitely not so high up on the agenda.
I think that's true. So let's go back and talk about this in a bit more detail.
Okay, well, you know, as you said, we've both been involved with banks where from a simple reading of their anti-money laundering policy, you'd think they'd be fine. And yet, when it comes to putting it into practice, they most definitely are not.
Absolutely. They're great on paper, dreadful on grass. It's the difference between regulating rules and regulating outcomes. There's no point having a detailed policy document, which looks great, if all you do is tick a box and not bother to understand why you're doing what you're doing, or in fact, bothering to care whether you are actually doing it, or having any idea what good actually looks like.
Yeah, I think that's a theme we'll be coming back to repeatedly. That's the difference between a quantitative and a qualitative approach to doing your KYC.
Oh, that's easy for you to say, Graham. then there's the bit about underestimating risks in respect of entities in low tax areas. And that, to me, is clearly referencing offshore or secrecy location companies.
Yes, I agree. I mean, low tax areas is quite a broad expression, but I can't think of any other reasonable interpretation.
Which means that even back in 2007, we can assume that there was significant corporate business with offshore companies.
Yes, and then there's this sentence relating specifically to the non-resident portfolio, where they are not in compliance, taking into account the specifics of the activities and associated risks. Now, that seems to indicate that they weren't doing proper enhanced due diligence, doesn't it?
It does, especially as it was followed by what they call a precept, which is essentially an enforcement notice requiring action.
Oh, do we know what the precept said?
Well, not in any detail, but we do know that one of the steps required by the regulator was the closing of 597 accounts relating to non-resident legal or natural persons in late 2007. And legal or natural persons just means corporate entities or individual clients.
Now that is fascinating. So they may well have closed a bunch of accounts, but I know because I have the bank statements that they were still opening accounts for legal persons as well.
Really? When were your accounts opened then?
Well, five of them were open between August and November 2007, and the sixth was opened back in 2006.
So at a time when the bank had been ordered to close non-resident legal person accounts, it was still opening new ones and clearly didn't close all of the existing accounts. Maybe these accounts weren't as high risk as some of the others. What would you say to that?
Well, once again, obviously, I can't tell you specifically who these accounts were, but I can tell you a bit more about their structure and locations.
Well, go on then.
All right, well, I've spoken at length about one of them being a UK limited liability partnership, and it had designated members who at the time were based in the British Virgin Islands and a trading address in Moscow, so that doesn't really need any further explanation.
Well, no, I mean, that's high risk, isn't it?
Well, I'd say so.
And the other five?
All of them have trading addresses in Moscow. One of them's a New Zealand company that was incorporated 4 months prior to opening the account. It's registered at an address in New Zealand we've already talked about. It's got two Latvian directors, one of whom's been director to 360 New Zealand companies, and the other one to a mere 893.
You know, Graham, there are times when you come out with this stuff and I think you're just making it up.
I wish I was, Ray. I really wish I was. The ownership of this company passes through four layers of intermediate corporate owners until eventually resolving to a Latvian shareholder.
Ah, right. Okay. So this brand new company is registered in New Zealand, operates in Russia, has two Latvian directors, and then when you pass it through four layers of corporate ownership, then appears to be owned by another Latvian resident in New Zealand. And it's opened an account in Estonia?
Yes.
Why?
Oh, I'm not sure anyone's ever asked that question before, Ray.
And was it an active account?
Well, for the 10 months it was in existence, yeah.
10 months, that's it?
Yes, but in those 10 months it managed to pack in credits of 40 million euros and $288 million.
Of course it did, Graham, of course it did. And this was one of the accounts they opened at the same time as receiving the precept from the Estonian FSA. Unbelievable. Okay, the next one?
Well, the next one is a nice, straightforward, vanilla British Virgin Islands registered company.
Okay, so this one's directly registered offshore, not through a UK or New Zealand proxy?
Yep.
Which would immediately elevate the risk, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I'd say so. This one was incorporated in April 2007, opened the account in October 2007, closed it in April 2009. It had a Panamanian corporate director, an operating address in Moscow, and 2,500 pages of bank statements.
You're joking.
No.
How much went in?
Well, ignoring the little bits of other currencies, just under $700 million.
Wow. I mean, I feel like we've been here before, but not with the context of an Estonian regulatory precept in the background. I mean, this really is quite shocking, isn't it?
Yes. I'm trying to be fair by allowing for this happening a while ago, but the importance in providing the data now is that this should all have been available to the bank as part of the onboarding process. So none of this is above and beyond the normal requirements at an account opening.
I mean, it'd be interesting to see what the bank holds on the nature and purpose of the relationship, wouldn't it?
It would. Why don't you explain what we mean by that for the benefit of anyone listening who may not fully understand?
Yeah, good idea. Okay. Well, when we talk about the nature of the relationship, we mean why the client and the bank established a business relationship and what type of relationship it is. So is it a lending relationship or a deposit holding or advisory or cash management relationship? And when we talk about the purpose of the relationship, we mean what exactly will the client be doing through the bank? For instance, do they want to have a line of credit to finance their trade activities? Do they want foreign currency services to pay for imported materials? Or is it one of a range of other possibilities?
Okay, that's pretty clear. And of course, the reason that the bank needs to have a very good grasp of these details is that it allows it to define very clearly what counts as normal when it comes to day-to-day dealings. So just to be clear, banks have had a legal obligation to know and record this information for a long time.
How long, Graham?
Well, it's been best practice for longer than this, but it was introduced as an explicit requirement in the EU's third anti-money laundering directive, which was published in November 2005.
I think we might be coming back to that directive in a couple of minutes, but for now, shall we move on?
Yeah, why don't we? The next one is also a BVI registered company, incorporated in July 2006, with an Indian director and shareholder. They opened the account in August 2007, closed it in September 2008, 13 months later. Total credits, 80 million euros. Oof. And $800 million.
Ouch. Whew. Go on then.
Number four is another BVI company, formed in May 2007 with British and Russian directors. The account opened in November 2007, closed 13 months later in December 2008. Credits were a mere €9 million and $30 million.
Oh, chicken feed, Graham. The last one?
Lastly, there's a Belizean company, but I can't find out much about this one. There's nothing in the Panama Papers or, frankly, anywhere else. Opened the account in 2006, closed it in 2011, and had credits of €46 million and $112 million.
Crikey. I really would love to see the bank's notes on the nature and purpose of these rather exotic relationships.
Yeah, me too.
So, let's just do a quick recap. Shortly after Danske took over the bank, they were served with a notice from the Estonian regulator highlighting shortfalls in the implementation of their anti-money laundering controls, which was then followed by a precept which required, amongst other things about which we don't know, the closing of a significant number of non-resident accounts.
Well, that's right so far.
At the same time, they were clearly opening new accounts in the non-resident portfolio for what were by any measure high-risk entities, which then commenced exceptionally high levels of activity, and none of them have any sort of online trading records or activity or, frankly, presence of any sort.
Yeah, that's just about spot on.
And this was all 10 years before any of this came to light.
Yes.
Now, I know we've gone off at a bit of a tangent, Graham, but this is important, and I'm not sure it's been fully reported up until now.
Ray, I agree. I think that's a dark money file scoop.
I think it probably is. Well, we were supposed to be talking about the structure of the Estonian branch and their systems and controls.
Well, I think we've probably made the case for the fact that the systems and controls were either not working or they were being circumvented in a pretty substantial way.
And, Graham, when we talk about systems and controls in this context, what sorts of things were expected?
Well, Ray, for this period, there's no better place to look than the EU's third anti-money laundering directive, which, although it was comparatively new at the time, did have the force of law behind it. As an example of the sorts of things they should have been doing for every client, let me read you this section of the directive. Quote, conducting ongoing monitoring of the business relationship, including scrutiny of transactions undertaken throughout the course of that relationship, to ensure that the transactions being conducted are consistent with the institution's or person's knowledge of the customer, the business and risk profile, including, where necessary, the source of funds, and ensuring that the documents, data or information held are kept up to date.
So if you have good documentation, which means you know who the client is, who the real person behind any corporate entity is, and what the nature and the purpose of the relationship that you maintain with this client is, you ought to be able to take a critical look at what's going on in the accounts on a day-to-day basis and know very easily whether what you're doing as a bank is right or wrong, shouldn't you?
Well, you'd think so, yeah, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Well, yeah, but we still haven't covered in detail the letter that was received around the same time from the Russian Central Bank.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. They sent a letter to the Danish FSA on the 8th of June, 2007. Regulators write to other regulators not infrequently when they think that the other regulator should know about something that's happening in their jurisdiction. And again, 2007, that's before many of these Russian-connected accounts were opened.
And what exactly did it say?
Well, we don't know all of it, but I can quote you one paragraph that makes for very interesting reading.
Go on.
Well, the B&H report quotes it directly. And it says, quote, clients of Sampo Bank permanently participate in financial transactions of doubtful origin, quote, estimated at, quote, billions of rubles monthly, quote. And then after a description of a type of transaction, the Russian Central Bank further stated that, quote, the mentioned transactions can be aimed at tax and custom payments evasion while importing the goods, or giving the legal form to the outflow of the capital, or they can be connected with the criminal activity in its pure form, including money laundering.
Well, Ray, I've got to say that's a pretty accurate description of some of the transactional activity I've seen in the bank statements, except that that activity was happening after this letter was received. So what happened next?
The Danish FSA sent it to the executive board of Danske Bank and asked for comments.
Ah, so we are getting to the structure of the bank and effectiveness of the reporting lines at last.
Yeah, or ineffectiveness, I suppose. The letter was put on the agenda of meetings held in August 2007 by both the executive board and the board of directors.
Well, that's taking it pretty seriously. So what happened?
A reply was sent to the Danish FSA by Group Legal on the 27th of August 2007.
And what did it say?
It said that the recent inspection report from the Estonian regulator had concluded that the bank, quotes, complies with the existing laws and regulations, quotes, and that the Estonian FSA had, quotes, no material observations, quotes. And it also said that the Danske Estonia branch had implemented the Danske Bank Group AML concept and that reporting lines had been set up.
Oh, hold on, Ray. I'm not sure that's what I took from the Estonian regulator's report. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it said that they were, quotes, mostly in compliance and that control systems had been set up in, quotes, principle, but that the bank's routine practice was not, quotes, fully in compliance with the requirements.
Yep.
So in my opinion, that does not agree with what the bank told the Danish FSA.
And based on what's in the B&H report, I'd have to agree with you, Graham. This is more than just a simplification or a summary. Intentionally or not, I'd say they misrepresented the report.
Yes, and based on the evidence of the bank statements, it carried on like that.
Given that the Estonian regulator served their precept after this letter went to the Danish FSA, you'd have thought that would have rung a few alarm bells. And the final piece relating to this is a note that the Danish FSA convened a meeting with the bank on the 3rd of September 2007, again before the Estonian precept had arrived. Now that was attended by Group Legal, who provided an equally comforting report. Apparently the Danish FSA had also talked to Group Internal Audit, which informed the FSA that local audit in Estonia had looked more closely into the matter and found nothing of note.
So even though within 2 weeks, on the 18th of September, the Estonian regulator thought things were bad enough to issue a precept, which, amongst other things, warranted the closing of 597 accounts. Ray, that just does not make sense.
And Graham, that's normally my line.
True, but it just doesn't. The board just have to have known that they were closing hundreds of accounts in Estonia. And yet there's just no evidence that they went back to the Danish FSA to alert them to this discrepancy between what they'd said and what they were now doing. And what's more, all this was happening at a time when, as we said at the start of this episode, the structure of the reporting lines was at its most basic.
I agree. And sadly, there the report leaves it and moves on to operations within the branch from 2008 to 2013.
And, well, I think we should do the same. But before we do, it's worth reflecting on the magnitude of what we've looked at today. Here is a bank that is told very firmly that there are weeds in their garden that they have to remove. At the very same time that they're doing so, they turn out to be not only planting more of the same weeds, but watering and caring for them as well. And at no time do they decide that the instructions to get rid of the existing weeds really implies that they shouldn't be planting twice as many new ones.
Not only that, but when another garden inspector arrives, they tell him everything's fine. The last garden inspector said we didn't have a weed problem, when actually the last garden inspector pointed out very clearly that they had a weed problem and told them exactly what they had to do about it.
I think that sums it up very nicely, Ray. So let's move on to the period 2008 to 2013 in the next episode. Mind you, having done a quick scan ahead, I think our next episode will be just as revelatory as this one.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.